Well, we'll just do a brief introduction. I know the two Ricks people know, but we have Rick Holland, Mike Summers, pastor of Countryside Baptist Church. You all know the man, the legend, Rick Gertson. And then Brett Laird, who's a missionary with Slavic Gospel Association. And we're going to start off with the first question, and I'm going to do a follow-up to this one. But is temptation in and of itself a sin?
No.
Okay. We got that one right. I was kind of nervous when you guys were looking at me. I thought it was obvious, but...
I was tempted.
Yes. Yeah. So when do you know? How do you know when something it has gone from temptation and it's just temptation to actually going into the sin category? When do you cross that threshold?
When desire is conceived.
Go. Speaking to the microphone.
When desire has conceived.
Okay.
So when you desire what you're being tempted by.
Okay. So how do you know when that happens? I mean, obviously, do you guys ever feel dirty about just being tempted? I mean, what do you do with that? Let's say you're really tempted to look at something or see something. Is that sin? Is that wrong to have that? How do you even just deal with some of the guilt after you kind of encounter that temptation?
Well, sin is... lust is connected to lust. Lust is epithumia in the Greek, and it just means a strong desire, and you were actually told to lust after God in 1 Thessalonians 1. So what? Jesus was an always tempted like us. So temptation in and of itself is an eviler that would have disqualified him from being, the Messiah and the Son of God. So temptation isn't bad. It's when temptation becomes a lust, a desire to be self-fulfilled rather than glorify God by obeying him and controlling that desire. All of us, to have your head turned by a girl that's pretty isn't necessarily a lust, isn't necessarily a sin. It's what you do with that thought. Matthew 5, if you commit adultery, if you go fornication, if you undress that thought, it's taking the temptation, Brett was saying in James 1, was conceived, and it becomes a desire that becomes self-satisfying, independent of honoring God, obeying God in his glory, and serving your own desire rather than his command, I think.
Yeah, and I guess one question to kind of ask is, you're driving by and you see a jogger, okay, not dressed modestly. You see her in her peripheral vision, okay? Is looking at that or noticing that? When do you kind of cross that threshold to... I mean, you always hear people looking at taking a second look or... And then some people say, well, I'm just taking a really long first look. Or just other ways that they... is it possible that maybe we kind of minimize the sin to allow more? Or are we kind of imposing some legalistic standards on ourselves by saying we notice a beautiful woman, for instance?
Yeah, in the session that dealt with, temptation is a heart issue. It is not necessarily an action issue. Okay. It's a heart issue, so it has to be dealt with at that heart level. The scenario you brought up, or it could be the same thing, we get smacked in the face on television commercials.
Yeah.
It just... shock value to get your attention. For me, the way that I address it in my own sinful heart is if I'm that's nice, and that's why I'm not going to look at that, because I don't want to gain any personal gratification or satisfaction in that woman who is not my wife. She may be beautiful, and I wouldn't, discount that, but when I'm looking because I'm finding some satisfaction in that, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And that's when it crosses over, in my mind, that threshold. And the same thing is true in media, is that it's that, hey, that gratification's there. How you doing,
Yeah, and I think you bring up a good point. I think just that our heart's even inclined to that. I mean, that's part of our sinful disposition to begin with. But let's kind of move on, kind of on the same topic. How much should you share with your wife about your sexual temptations? Brett, we'll go ahead and start with you, since this is a hard one.
That's why I didn't want to sit there.
No, the hot seat, yeah.
I would say that the general principle is that at the Bema seat, the judgment seat of Christ, there should be nothing that surprises your wife. So I don't think you have to share all the details, but there should be no category of sin that has occurred that she doesn't know about. So kind of take that's kind of principle I apply is I have to be able to say before the Lord and before her, I don't have any secrets. Mm-hmm.
I love that. But
see, this is when it gets good. Go ahead.
I would say this for the man, for the man who's battling with this. If you have a pornographic mind, and you are using your privacy from your wife in order to hide that pornographic mind, you're setting yourself up for further failure. And what you're doing is setting your wife up not to trust you. For me personally, and I've been married now for 30-plus years, my wife and I have...
How old were you when you got married?
Was it like... At my bar mitzvah.
Okay, 12 years old.
made it a point because I want my wife to be... She is my... she is my partner in life, for life, and I want her to be my everything. So I want her to know where I struggle and where I'm weak. My wife knows that, you know what, there are certain places that I'm not going to ask my husband to go with me to, just because I understand him. It's not that I'm, you know, I'm 51 years old. It's not that I'm this pervert, but I just don't want to, I want to have a pure mind. I don't want to struggle, and I want to be able to keep that clear. So I communicate with my wife mm-hmm. what I struggle with. Now, let's say that there is there's a failure, a moral failure in my mind, and there is sinful. I'm going to try to use code words because I'm looking around and I need to use code words. So. Mm-hmm. That there is a sinful expression of self-gratification. I'm going to let my wife know that's an area that I'm struggling with, okay? I'm battling with that. But here's the great thing. When you're honest with your wife, she wants to do everything within her power to help you succeed. And that means not just keeping you from what is bad, but she really wants to be all about helping you with what is good. So, trying to use code.
Yeah, very discreet.
I think I figured it out.
You make the author of Song of Solomon's proud. So.
I'm just using code because I'm concerned for Rick.
Yeah. Rick, do you guys want to add anything to this?
No, I think the principle Mike laid out is good. I think she needs to know our struggles. Our wives need to know our battles, but they don't need to know every detail and every time you fell. I mean, I think... Yeah. I mean, you don't have to come home and say, okay, there's six times you need to know about, or there's three times, or, you know, and it's this person and that person. And, you know, I don't think that has to go with that level, but I think she needs to know that's something that's an area. I think Mike is right that your wife needs to help you mm-hmm. in those areas, and I like the way he said it. She needs to help you with what is good.
Yeah.
And I think our churches need to teach our ladies that availability. And those things are important from her aspect. Mm-hmm. But there are so many guys out there that really work through, even though they may not turn a page in a magazine ever in their life, it's easy for us to walk by, see, look at, and begin to objectify women. So it's nothing more than ways for our eyes and our heart to be satisfied mm-hmm. by what we see, and it doesn't require those women to be scantily clad at all. And it is a battle in the heart, and God absolutely gives a victory over. Mm-hmm. You have to pray about that victory. You have to ask God to give you that victory, and you have to supply the spiritual discipline of your heart and the power of the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. And I think the plea of our heart for many of us needs to be, God, I just need a power that's not mine, because this temptation is common to man, but it is powerful in me. Mm-hmm. And ask for the Holy Spirit to help us with that. And when that sight happens, before it becomes a gratification, we need to begin the process of praying. And for some of us, that means we pray 25,000 times a day.
Yeah.
And that's what it takes. Just that type of Father, help me, and mm-hmm. do that. But I do think your wife needs to know your struggles and your battles.
Yeah.
And if she does, then she will remind you during the sporting contest to get up and go to the bathroom and not watch the commercial. Or maybe you need to tape every game so you can fast forward every commercial. Mm-hmm. And you and your wife need to talk about that. Or you mute the TV, you turn, swing your chair around, you talk to your wife during every commercial. Something that makes it happen, however that is. But I think she needs to know the battles, but not necessarily every detail and every failure.
Yeah. Any thoughts, Rick?
Well, yeah, I'm trying to phrase what I want to say without disagreeing with what you guys have said. But I think that there are some guys who are prone to, whose consciences are so sensitive, who are prone to overconfess. And once you begin using your wife as your priest, you're in a lot of trouble. And not only that, you'll destroy your wife. I've counseled a guy who began going down a road of confessing to his wife every time he lusted, and the marriage lasted about 8 months after that, and she left him. And the reason is, she said, I can never be what your fantasies are feeding you. Now, obviously, there's way more problems than that. Categorically, I think that Rick, when you said in categories, I think that's fine. But if we have to be careful, she's not our priest, and we confess that to the Lord, she can know where we struggle. She should ask. No questions she asks should go unanswered. Mm-hmm. But whether it's your wife or your accountability partner or your discipleship leader, just be careful that the catharsis of that confession makes you think that you've now become right with God.
Yeah,
that's good. Just some balance to that is, I think this is important, guys, for your wife. If she senses you're living a secret life, mm-hmm. big problem. Big problem. And I just I would hate to think that a guy would use that, because I agree 100% with what Rick has said. To your wife is not your priest, and she is not your overseer. She is not the one you are accountable to. God is. However, if you are using that as an excuse to live a secret life of shame, and the balloon bursts, mm-hmm. your wife is going to be devastated. That who is this man that I've been married to?
Yeah. I would say one thing that my wife kind of puts in place is she makes sure that I'm accountable to somebody. You know, that there's somebody, let's say it's Brett. She'll ask me, so have you talked to Brett lately? And that's code for, you need to talk to Brett. And that's kind of helpful too, because I think my wife wants to know that I have somebody who's going to ask me really, really penetrating questions. And she kind of pushes me towards that. But she also, I think in a general way, wants to know how I'm doing it without the specifics. Well, let's move on to the next question regarding laziness. How do you suggest discerning between laziness and a need, desire, if it's valid, for relaxation?
You need to start that, since you taught on that.
Oh, but I don't want to. I want you guys to go before I give the right answer. All right, I'll answer it. I would say relaxation. I think the preferred word I would use would be recreation, which is recreation. I mean, what are those things that really refresh you, recreate you, and you know that it happens. If working with wood and working with your hands is something that just really helps you get focused, or bush hogging or something like that, or hunting, I would just say, just make sure, seek to have a purpose with it. You know, the purpose is for me to be refreshed, to be recreated, to be ready to serve. and really work again. If something helps you to do that, know what that is. Have a good idea of how much time you need to adequately do it, and just set a benchmark. And I'd also say if you plan on it, it's a lot better. Like, I'm a big Jayhawk fan, okay? They're playing Oklahoma right now. I don't know the score, and I don't want to know. But I think what I have to do is I have to plan which games I'm going to watch this week, right? I have, well, really no games this week because I'm busy every time. But just knowing what it is, do you know what I'm saying? Kind of planning ahead and planning on the recreation, and that way you don't slip into involuntary recreation that can lead to a lot of indolence. Would you guys add anything to that?
I feel bad for the entire Tennessee Volunteer Nation because if they were better, and I actually mean this sincerely, it would drive more of my Saturdays. And so God has cursed that team for my sanctification. Yes. And I'm very grateful for that. I feel bad for everyone else who's...
There's probably a lot of people in Tennessee praying for your sanctification.
And they should be.
Yeah, that's right. Well, here's another question. From a biblical perspective... Can addictions be stopped abruptly, or is it a gradual process of leaving? Addictions, right? From a biblical perspective, can addictions be stopped abruptly, or is it a gradual process of leaving?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes yes, sometimes. I've seen guys come off crack cocaine and never go back, and I've seen people who need to be checked into a rehab facility because physically they needed to be weaned off of it. And I just think I'm not sure it's a yes or no,
okay,
you know, absolute answer, but the there is no sin over which God's power is is not potent. So.
Okay.
Perhaps we could say that the spiritual repentance has to be complete and immediate. Like, let's use the drug addiction concept. So the person has to be fully repentant. I mean, he can't have a plan to just cut back on his sin. Mm-hmm. So in his heart, he has to have this is the last time ever I'm never touching another, you know, another drop of alcohol or another what. There are some drugs that create a physical dependence, which can actually kill you through immediate withdrawals. And so in that case, I believe it is appropriate sometimes for a doctor to actually control, basically through controlled administrations of synthetic versions of that, to step them down. I think the physical, weaning the physical body off of its dependence can be gradual, but the decision to repent and turn needs to be full and immediate. That would be kind of my take on it.
Yeah, I would say sometimes, even within the person, sometimes they have immediate things that just end, and then sometimes it's more of a struggle. But I think the big thing, as long as you're struggling with it, and sometimes just the temptation's always there too. Here's another question. How do we balance friendships with unbelievers with the mandate to flee Sodom? Better yet, can we? I mean, when do we draw that line?
Well, I think every friendship with anybody that doesn't know Christ has one purpose. And that is to evangelize them and bring them to the Lord. It doesn't mean that every conversation has to be hammering them with, you know, the Romans Road or whatever, or whatever you want to try. But I think that's the goal. And so if we can go back to Sodom, I think that was not Lot's goal. Mm-hmm. Lot's goal for going there was he wanted a relationship and a part of that city, and it had nothing to do with evangelizing that city whatsoever. It was not a part of his goal, his thinking, or anything like that. So he was very comfortable. I have a friend, and believe it or not, yeah, thank you. And he and I get together about once a month and pray very hard for his life and his salvation. And we're good friends, but you know, it doesn't come up a whole lot. He used to attend church now and then, doesn't. And you know, last time out of the blue, he asked me for a Bible. And I'm excited about that, but I don't, I mean, we have lunch, and you know, I'm always the one who prays. He doesn't ever pray, but mm-hmm. he always asks me to pray for the meal, and we do that, and we fish now and then together and so forth. But the goal of that, even though we share a lot of common interests and things like that, the goal of my meeting and the prayer before we ever get together and on the way to those things is that God would open doors and do that. So the goal of any friendship I have with anybody that's not a believer is evangelism. Mm-hmm. And the goal of any relationship I have with anybody who is a believer is edification. Mm-hmm. So I have two very clear goals with whoever I'm a friend with.
Okay. Well, maybe for some people, well, I mean, you guys all have, everybody has sons, right? So when do you intervene and just say, I see this friend having a really adverse impact on your life? I mean, how do you kind of gauge that? When is there the time that you kind of intervene and say, this really has to stop? I mean, when did your dad do that?
My dad? Yeah, when I was, it was easy. Yeah, when I was not doing what I should have been doing, sin was clearly there, and I was being pulled to the world, and the police came by the house, and no, I was kidding. It's a joke. My son's here. That was a joke. No, I mean, it was evident to my parents that, you know, I didn't want the friendship to end. I was having a blast. Uh-huh. You know, I wasn't mature enough to stop that. And I think we need to think through, why am I evangelizing this friendship?
Okay.
And am I, as the force of this friendship, and my goal of this friendship, that he would come to know Christ? Not, he's got great hunting land and maybe he'll let me hunt on it. Mm-hmm. You know, but the fact that I am still praying through and still wanting, and is that, you know,
sure,
the goal of friendship?
You have any thoughts, Mike?
Well, I wasn't raised in a Christian home, so I pretty much did whatever I wanted. But mm-hmm. I have six kids, five of whom are boys. Mm. My guys were very involved in community sports, and mm-hmm. I wanted to be involved with them, so I coached whenever mm-hmm. I could. And when they were young, and my daughter the same way, when they were young, we had just for a protection thing, we had a deal where if they wanted to spend the night with someone, that was fine, but that someone had to be in our home because I didn't know what went on there, and I just felt mm-hmm. responsible. But that's not necessarily, I mean, mm-hmm. what we're talking about from my perspective are not, you know, biblical truths where uh-huh. there's chapter and verse that says this is what you do. It's just it's just parenting with wisdom and mm-hmm. seeking to know your kids and know what they need. So I was trying to recall, as Rick was talking about General Patton and what he did for him, what mm-hmm. I don't know that we've ever stepped in and said to the guys, you need to step away from this friendship.
Yeah, one passage that comes to my mind is 1 Corinthians 15. Is it 33? Bad company corrupts good morals. And the great analogy I heard about it is, somebody asked, are you a thermostat or a thermometer? Like, do you adjust to the temperature in the room, or do you determine the temperature in the room? Do you know what I'm saying? And so I think a lot of times you can have friendships with non-Christians on your terms. Like, hey, would you like to hang out at the frat party? No, let's get coffee, right? Unless they're Mormons, they wouldn't want to get coffee. You get lemonade with them. So you make some adjustments. So I think that's one to keep in mind. All right. Okay, given that we are told that we must toil in the field after Adam's fall, work is a blessing, money is a type of scorecard by society, how are Christian men to reconcile a healthy attitude towards careers without becoming a lover of money? Did you get that? Okay. What do you think, Rick?
Well, the Protestant work ethic says make all the money you can so you can extend God's kingdom. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of invest, make money, make all you can, but don't hoard it. Use it for that which is eternal, which is souls. Mm-hmm. You know, I languish when I see, you know, missionaries coming off the field because they can't be funded, and men have 401ks that could fund, you know, multiple years of their ministry. There's nothing wrong with saving. There's nothing wrong with work hard and make money. The vocational impact of the Protestant Reformation was that. And I think that the countries that have been impacted by that are the ones that are the wealthiest in the world. It's just a matter of what you do. Remember what we alluded to it this morning. Paul didn't say that the love of or that money is the root of all evil. It's the love of money that's the root of all evil. Even James 1 says it's not bad to be rich, it's just hard. And as a footnote to that, by the way, all of you in this room, all of you, 100% of you are rich. Matthew 6 says if you know where you're going to sleep tonight, if you know where you're going to sleep tonight and tomorrow night, if you have more than one pair of clothes, then you're rich according to Christ's standards. Rick just came back from Zimbabwe. I could take you to places in Africa that I've seen that you come home and you just say, really, do I need this and that? And it's humbling. So it's not the money. I'd say make all the money you can to extend God's kingdom. And there's nothing wrong with making money.
Yeah, I think sometimes we get a sense where there is a holier aspect if I don't have as much, and that's not the issue. I think the issue is what you do with what you have. Mm-hmm. And I think if I can work this job and make $30,000 a year, or I work the exact same job and make $50,000 a year, there's a wisdom issue here, mm-hmm. right? There's an investment of your time, mm-hmm. you know, and if everything being equal, why wouldn't you? And I think we are to work hard. I think we are to make money. And I think Rick is why. Am I working for the extra for me, or am I working for the kingdom? And I think that's the principle we get messed up. God isn't, I mean, he's not trying to be this complete killjoy in the sense of not letting you. But the reality is a lot of us are working hard for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I'm 87 and have $3 million, mm-hmm. really? I can't walk. Mm-hmm. You know, what am I going to do with the $3 million, you know? And mm-hmm. there isn't that respect in leaving some to your wives and leaving some to your children and stuff like that. But really, I think we just need to think that through a little bit differently with regard to, yeah, make a lot, but give a lot, yeah. right? And not just hoard stuff up for ourselves.
Okay. Kind of a different topic. A couple of questions came in about this topic. What is the best way, according to the Bible, to overcome sinful anger? Somebody loses their temper, fly off the handle. What do you tell them? Brett, once again, I'll put you on the spot.
I think that generally anger comes from when someone or something keeps you from getting what you want. Mm-hmm. So the only way to overcome the anger is you have to deal with that inordinate desire to achieve whatever it is you're trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. I think the outbursts of anger are more the symptom rather than the cause. So I would go more after the desire level. You know, why am I attacking who or what is keeping me from my goal?
Yeah, I guess one verse that you kind of triggered is James 4, 1 through 2, which is probably one of the most important counseling verses in the Bible, right? What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions or desires are at war within you? You desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. And so I think that's kind of a recognition of what's the desire within you. We're going to add anything to that, Mike, or did you have a thought?
I was going to say, so much of these topics really go back to worship, what we worship, who we mm-hmm. worship, and whether it's money in our attitudes and views toward money, or whether it's sex and our attitudes and views toward lust, or whether it's anger. And, mm-hmm. you know, the truth is, in my life, when I start finding myself mm-hmm. Getting angry, I need to look back and see what idol in my life is being threatened at that moment. That really helps me identify mm-hmm. the problem of mm-hmm. that. So I think just like sex, to deal with it on an external level and try to say, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to hold my breath or count to 10 or try to do some external way to try to keep it in check, I'm going to fail. And what I've got to do is deal with it on the heart level. Mm-hmm. It's a heart issue. And I have to approach it on a hard issue, and mm-hmm. and therefore, it goes back to what I am worshiping. And unfortunately, we marginalize God and exalt ourselves. And when something intersects that or our mm-hmm. agenda, we get ticked.
Yeah,
I would say that. Yeah, for example, I have young children, so you know, you blow your top because your child spilled you know, on the couch or something like that. You lost the battle not when you blew up at the child, but when having the couch or whatever it is that you wanted became too important to you, you know.
Yeah.
Or you're driving home and you're just so looking forward to, you know, watching the game, and that desire takes hold in the heart, and then a phone call happens or something that keeps you from that. So you have to kind of win it. You have to win the battle of anger when you're not angry, because anger is a manifestation of trying to grasp on. That's what Mike said.
Yeah. Let's move on to another one. Okay, this will be interesting. What safeguards do you put in place to protect yourself from sexual sins? Maybe we'll have everyone just kind of share a little bit. Starting with you, Rick, on the far end.
I'm trying to edit because I know we have single guys here, but I think that if, Mike, you said this very much better than I could, but if a healthy relationship with your wife at home in an intimate way is what God has intended to so mitigate a lot of those temptations. And so the answer to that, single guys, is find a wife. That's the and actually, I'm not kidding. So I think it starts with there. Let me just say, a healthy sex life at home mitigates a lot of temptation outside the home, period. Okay. So that's important. But I the reason I'm hesitating, Dave, is sexual sin in the mind at 50 is so much different than sexual sin in the mind when I was 18. Mm-hmm. And it brings a level of anger even at myself that didn't used to. I heard John MacArthur say one time, you know, that's a young man's sin. It just matures very differently as you get older. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's not to sit down on my computer or my iPad or phone and look at pornography. For me, it's the glances that can become advances. I didn't mean for that to rhyme, but that's exactly what happens, is that a thought look, there's nothing wrong. I think you said it a minute ago, Brett. There's nothing wrong with saying that woman's pretty. It's so I want to, you know, XYZ in my mind. That's when you cross the line. So for me, it's grabbing the thought from the recognition of beauty, and to be blunt, it's prayer. You see that, you say, Lord, thank you for making her look like that for your glory. And thank you for Kim. And then just to shift into a right thinking about that whole category. There's just no way you can walk through life not recognizing that God has made pretty girls on this planet. Mm-hmm. And thank the Lord for it. I hope whoever said that's right was talking about their wife.
or daughters.
And mine. But it's a matter of the thought in the moment. It's the thought in the instant, you were talking about idols. That's an idol, mm-hmm. And to recognize this is an object of my worship that is going to end in my corruption.
Yeah.
But it never goes away. Mm-hmm. I don't want to discourage you, young guys. It never goes away. And so, one of you, I think Rick, you were saying earlier in your sermon that this is the time to get traction on battles like that, because if you don't, that will plague you and haunt you so horrifically the rest of your life. So, thanking God for beauty, and then thinking about my wife and thanking God for her is a simple answer.
Mike, would you add anything to that?
I think the realm that I'm kind of running in is a little bit different than where I was years and years ago when sexual lust was such a thing. I got kicked out of the house at 16 and lived on my own, and so I was pretty free to, you know, do whatever. But I came to Christ and got married, and really wanted Christ to have my heart. Then going into ministry, it's really different. Here's how my wife helps me, because that's the specific question. Mm-hmm. The five of us that are up here, we spend a good deal of our time helping people spiritually and talking to people spiritually. And we're not just the pastors of the men in our church. We're also the pastors of females. And there's a real danger in that. All of these guys could testify. You know, we're maybe perceived through lenses that think that we're perfect and that you know we're spiritual giants. I'm talking about if
my guys Mike, don't
Mike,
think of me
you
like
know,
that.
You don't need to give that away.
Well, I don't think any of these guys think that. But if a wife is living with a guy, he's not leading. He's dropping the ball. She sees all of his flaws, and then she only gets a glimpse of Rick Holland on Sunday. And boy, he looks so sharp. He's got it together. He's speaking authoritatively. He gives such truth. He's so witty and humorous. And you know, I've got Delbert next to me, who's just a complete idiot. And so she goes to Rick for counseling. It can be a temptation for him to really exalt himself and to feel like I'm helping this, really doing a good job helping this poor woman. I'm meeting her needs, and and so for me, how my wife helps me is she grounds me.
Yeah,
you know, she reminds me just with an accurate holds the mirror up. Here's who you really are, baby.
Rick.
Well, I'll take it from this point of view. Chris and I, years ago, sat down and we just talked about parameters that we each would have with the opposite sex, just to give us confidence where each other was at. We won't ride in a car with anybody alone, you know, especially with regard to the professional life. Doors are always opened, never shut when it's the opposite sex. We just went through a whole list of things, and so we have an agreement that so she comes popping into the church and I'm in my office and a woman's in there, and the door's open, and she knows that. And so we, in that sense, we sat down, and there were times when our kids were playing sports and things like that something would happen, and another woman needed a ride, and she was over there, and I just like, can't, sorry. And I remember years ago, a woman came to church, her husband had just blitzed, and it was a Sunday night, and we were getting ready to go, and Chris wasn't there, and we needed to go back to her house because it was a bad scene and everything went up. And I had to go get another guy and his wife and say, would you mind taking this woman to her home, and I'll meet you there, because I wasn't going to go there alone, you know. And we were like the last few people leaving the church, and family's like, what are you talking about? Why can't you just, you know, I'm like, sorry. But, you know, we need to have, so between us, we have these parameters that we have that we do no matter what, and we trust each other to make sure that happens. And so that's one of the hedges that we did. We sat down, talked about what we will and won't do and what to expect. Don't go to lunch with somebody.
Yeah.
You know, just, I mean, some of it's very common sense. Some of it's, you know, you may not want to do, but it's something that we've discussed in the parameters we put together.
Yeah. Brett?
Yeah, I had a little bit of it in life, kind of an interesting thing, you know. I mean, in high school and stuff, probably, even if I wanted the attention of girls, I probably couldn't get it. I was kind of a nerd and didn't really know how to talk to them. And then all of a sudden, you go overseas, and all of a sudden, you are rich, and you are, you know, you're a ticket somewhere. And so one of the things that I learned by necessity really quick over there is I had to learn to use formal speech with other women. Mm-hmm. And in English, we've lost this a little bit. Almost all English now is informal. In Russian, there's a very distinct form of address that you use when it's someone that is your family or your personal friend or someone that you want to become a personal friend. And then there's a formal language that you use in classrooms, you know, with teachers and with officials. And so just, you know, one of the ways that as I use formal speech, because that sends a signal, look, I care about you, I respect you, but our relationship is an arm's length relationship and will always be that way. And in English, we don't have the grammatical distinctions like there are in Russian, but there are still those cues that we send with our speech. And so I would say use arm's length language. It doesn't mean you can't express that God, you know, we need to express the love of Christ, but your manner of speaking communicates what your intentions are. And along with that, I would say, is be very proactive in discussing the blessings that the Lord has given you if you're married. You know, talk a lot about your wife.
Yeah, one thing I would add is just learn not to be secretive. Like, I have two computer monitors that, and I don't have a blinds on my window into my office. Anybody could walk by at any time and see what's on my computer screen. My elders get a copy of Covenant
Eyes. It's on ESPN, don't they?
Sometimes, actually. During the NCAA tournament, I must say, I need to listen to my laziness talk again. But that's, so that's something I do. It's just not having a secretive life. Yeah. You know, men who really keep secrets and really like privacy and stuff like that, that's often a warning sign for me. It's like, why aren't you being transparent? Why aren't you being open? And just realizing that it's a battle everyone faces. I think the other one, too, this was on our wedding ring, Song of Solomon 8:6, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death, jealousy is fierce as the grave. And I'm very jealous for my wife's affection, and my wife is very jealous for my affection. And it's the fear of God and the fear of my wife that really protects me. And that's a good thing, you know what I'm saying? I want to nurture that, you know, and let her be jealous. And don't be, oh, come on, you know, it's just some, I mean, don't push that off. If your wife has a sixth sense about someone, it's like, yes, ma'am. I mean, you just kind of go along with it. So kind of a shout out to the single men. How does a single young man go about finding a wife while living a true Christian life? So, Rick, you are the relationship guru.
That would be you.
He said Rick.
No.
Yeah. Well, you have that famous sermon series on it that
well,
everyone...
It takes 12 hours to go through that.
Yeah.
You know, be a godly man and find a godly woman and recognize that you're going to spend the rest of your life trying to glorify God with someone. Looks are important, but they're not nearly as important as you think. Now, I'm not telling you go marry an ugly girl just because she's ugly. But just remember that time doesn't always keep you or her looking the way you do on your wedding day for all of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a series of principles. You want to make sure that you are you have the right people involved, and mm-hmm. I'd say that will cover a multitude of errors. Make sure that your pastor, your youth pastor, your elders, your parents. What if my parents are unbelievers? Your parents are involved in looking mm-hmm. at what you're doing and giving approval. If someone who's of significant respect in your life has an issue with that relationship, I would hit the brakes immediately.
Yeah.
And I think either we could go into 1,000 other principles. That one alone will give you such guidance, is to trust the people that God's given in your life to give leadership, to give approval. The second anything pops on the horizon as maybe this is going somewhere, get your parents and your leaders involved so they can help walk that through on whether it's wise for you and this gal.
I think if I could say something to the single guys, you know what, we heard it this morning, you know, be a man, and more importantly, be a godly man. Today, young men tend to want to mm-hmm. prolong their adolescence, their childhood, and mm-hmm. and so they're all wrapped up in boy things, you know, little boy, playing games. You know what? That's not attractive to a godly woman. She doesn't want to be your mom. She wants to be your wife, somebody who can follow your leadership. Be a man. If you want to... I would say this, don't be as concerned about finding the right one as you are about God making you the right one for the right woman. Mm-hmm. And that needs to be, you know, your pursuit right now.
If I could follow up with what you said about parents. So you think the parents should pick their son's wife?
Where's
I went
Jacob?
On record.
No.
Because
no,
I tried
no,
that. It's not working real good with my son.
You can try that, yeah. No, just be involved.
I offer to pay his dates, but
yeah,
he won't.
That's good. I have discussions with my three boys as
you know,
well. You know, just
you didn't help me.
Said
you were supposed to answer that differently.
Yeah, I just listen. Single guys, listen to girls talk or ask girls what they talk about if they'll be honest with you. No group of girls ever gets together and says, "He had high score on Halo." I mean, it's... Yeah. He was really good at... What's the combat one? The kill the other...
Black Ops. Call of Duty.
He's a Call of Duty hero. That's just... Grow up. Agreed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I would say this. Work hard at getting a good job and being a provider. I think that's something where women want to be able to nurture their children, have the freedom to do that, and they want to know that they'll marry a responsible man who will sacrificially give himself to providing for the family. I'd say that's very important. And two, seek to be a leader. I mean, not that you have to be leading small groups, but just somebody who is faithful, someone who is reliable, someone with proven character, being really active in ministry. And the reality is, and I think you guys would probably agree with me, there's way more godly women than godly men out there. And there's way more single godly women than godly men. And
there's more stupid godly guys who won't recognize these godly women.
Exactly.
Who are stupid.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there's a shortage, you know, and so it's kind of like if you're not getting married, you're either being foolish or not really being the type of person that she's willing to walk out of singleness and marry. Because, yeah.
Go ahead. Well, I told this to my daughters, and I think it's applicable for the men too. If you're out there looking and kind of desperately so, you're not attracted to the right kind of guy or the right kind of girl. But as a single person, if you're content and striving to be godly and serving the Lord, then you become attracted to the right kind of mate. But if you're out there desperate and hoping and seeking and doing all that, then you're going to attract somebody, but it's not going to be the one you really want. Be content with where God has you and strive to be the godly person that you need to be, and then that will attract the right person for you.
Brett?
So it's kind of funny because I was going to talk about the similar thing, but from the opposite side. I think there are some guys that portray desperate, and that is definitely a turnoff. There are other guys who want to become leaders passively, right? They want to find a wife without looking, and so they're too timid to look. They're also too proud to have anyone help them, and so you know it's different. You know, different guys struggle with different things, but there are guys who are just too timid. They're not looking. They want the Lord to wrap her up and drop her on the doorstep with a big sign.
They want to find out if she likes him before he asks her out.
Exactly. Yeah. He needs to be sure that he won't be rejected. Mm-hmm. And so part of it is pride and things like that. So I would say to that type of a guy, humble yourself enough to ask for help. You may need a good recommendation. You may need a little matchmaking, appropriate matchmaking. And the other thing I'd say is kind of to try to balance the two is, women are like bunny rabbits, you know. There's only two ways to catch them. You either have to rush up on them so fast that they don't even know what was coming, or you have to sneak up on them so slowly they don't know you're coming. So if
is that a Russian proverb or something?
If you've been bum rushing
and men are like coyotes.
But if you've been bum-rushing girls and they've been escaping, you need to back off.
Yeah.
If you've been approaching so slowly, they got bored and wandered off before you got there, then you may need to get more aggressive.
Yeah, just I was asked this on a radio show at one point in a caustic way by the interviewer, because I'd written this article that this gal had disagreed with. She was calling in from a Texas radio show. And she says, "So, Pastor Holland, do you really think the church should be a matchmaking institution?" Expecting me to say, "Well, no." And I said, "Well, yes. Shouldn't it?"
Yeah.
Isn't that where you should find your spouse as a Christian? We should be a matchmaking institution in the church.
Yeah. So. I tell our young men in our college group, and this is a small town business slogan, shop Emporia first. I mean, they've heard me. I was like, why are you looking at these other churches? I mean, they're all right here. I mean, you know what they believe. You know what their character is. And I think sometimes guys are just, well, I saw her picture on Facebook, and she put Christian in her religion, and she has a Bible verse for a quote. She's solid, right? And it's kind of like, you know the character, you know the flaws. And sometimes we just kind of, there's this allure of the girl who's far away. instead of the one who's familiar. And yeah, just open your eyes. Well, we'll go to we'll do two more questions. I'll see which ones. Okay. Rick, you're on the spot here. This is directed towards you. You mentioned a man who called ahead to a hotel to remove the TV and that his heart wasn't right. How would you relate this to Jesus' command in Matthew 5, 27 through 30? You know, you gouged out your eye, cut off your hand. And what is the difference between being obedient to Jesus' command and having remaining sin in your heart?
Yeah, good question. Jesus wasn't being literal, but because it's a bizarre command. I mean, have you really read Matthew 5? Mm-hmm. He says, if your right hand makes you sin, cut it off. Now, you better hope you're left-handed, because then he says, pick up that hand and throw it far from you. Wouldn't it have been enough just to cut it off? If your right eye makes you sin, pluck it out. Pick it up and throw it from you. He goes to that. So his point is not to be literal. His point is to deal with your heart, do radical extremes. If you want to take a TV out of your hotel room, that's okay. Mm-hmm. If that helps you, no big deal. My point was, if you have to do that, you better be asking questions about what made you have to do that with your heart before you just start trying to eradicate every... And that's the point. You cannot eradicate every temptation around you. And so remove the TV from the hotel room. If that helps you for that night or those couple nights, that's great. But you're still going to walk around with whatever caused you to have that temptation be such a radical thing that you had to do that in the first place. So the point of Jesus' statement in Matthew 5 is deal with what's in your heart. Mm-hmm. And look, I travel a lot. I have to, this is not a foreign temptation. I understand it. I like watching ESPN at night. I understand what that means. So I have to pick up the hotel guide, look at exactly what channel ESPN is, turn the volume down, guard my eyes, plug it in, and go to ESPN. And that's the only channel I'm gonna watch. Because there's stuff on that television that would never come into my house. Mm-hmm. So you have to make those little decisions. And I have to guard my own heart on that. But Jesus' point is, it's not about physical cutting off of your limbs. It's about dealing with your heart. If it was, then none of us would be able to see or feel anything. Mm. Right?
Yeah, so. I'll do one more question. I think it's probably an important question, at least for the person who wrote it. How do I know for sure God has not disowned me forever because of my sinful heart and disobedience? Yeah, I'm glad you're asking the question. Somebody want to, Mike?
I would say because, and Rick said it under his breath, it's because you're asking the question, and that's the right question. If you're battling with sin, and you're grieved over it and you're burdened over it, that's God telling you to do something about it. And actually, it's God telling you He's done something about it and calling you to come to Him. That's a great thing. And just to recognize the confidence that we have because of the shed blood of Jesus Christ. Anybody who's concerned about their soul, like you are, they by being concerned for their soul, are giving evidence that God has not abandoned them and given them over to a mind that is reprobate.
Yeah, and I would say this. Don't isolate yourself. I mean, if you're really struggling with those issues, that's what the pastor's for. I think a lot of times Satan wants you to believe that the pastors and the people in the church aren't on your side. You know, we do want to help you. I think all of us can just tell you we all struggled with sin. We still struggle with sin. We'll continue to do so. And so the worst thing you can do is just kind of be by yourself. Go to a mature man, perhaps a pastor who brought you here, and read 1 John. Yeah, there's some great promises in there. And then, obviously, we know that through the promises of God, if you confess with your mouth Jesus is the Lord and believe in your heart God raised Him from the dead, you will be saved, right? That's assurance. We know that the fruit of the changed life gives us assurance. The internal testimony gives us assurance. And our assurance goes up and down. Our salvation is static, but our assurance can go up and down. And, you know, it might be you might have something in your life that's just taken away some assurance of salvation. You're really troubled by something. That's good. And I would just lay that on the altar, give it to the Lord, and that assurance will come back. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for I think doing a great job of answering the question, so we appreciate it.